Pack up your bags, all set to fly, wheels up to somewhere new. Let's take a ride up in the sky, wings on the open blue. Cause we got today, don't wait for tomorrow. You pick the place, let's go. Let's travel the world.
Hello there and welcome to the very first episode of Flight Plan. I am Fernando Pinho, your fellow pilot and host of the show. Here we will discover fantastic destinations for your next private flying adventure in UK and Europe. From national parks and beaches to charming villages and bustling towns, together we will reveal some of the hidden gems that await you and your loved ones after landing. In this podcast, we'll also be joined by fellow pilots and seasoned travelers who will share their favorite flight destinations and personal experiences. Get ready to be inspired by their thrilling stories while collecting plenty of tips on how to make the most of your pilot's license. So strap in and let's embark on a journey full of unforgettable sights and experiences, all from the unique perspective of private pilots. Okay, all good? We are ready for departure. Our guest today is Dutch-American, born in France and lived for a long time in Spain and Switzerland until moved to the UK 13 years ago. He worked directly for Cirrus Aircraft, and it was during that time that I first met him. At a meeting, I naively asked him if I could order a plane painted in white. And he answered, "Cirrus does beautiful white airplanes." In 2018, he founded Ashland Air, a company specialized in providing tailored flight training, flying adventures, aircraft management, and sales. He is known for his extensive experience flying all around the world and in most weather conditions. He knows almost no boundaries when it comes to exploring new places, making the most of personal aviation, and inspiring others to do the same. And for that reason, Philippe Pullman is our first guest. Philippe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Fernando. Really nice to reconnect on this forum, and very excited to swap flying stories.
Indeed, I think there's a lot to talk about. I would like to start the podcast with a quick fire round of questions. And we have some very simple rules. You can say yes or no or maybe and give a one-sentence answer if you really have to. And then later in the episode, we'll go back to these themes. Are you ready?
I'm ready. The pressure's on.
Is it easier to fly in continental Europe than in the UK?
Yes. VFR, for sure. IFR is broadly the same.
Can you easily fly in visual flying rules in Europe?
Yes.
Shall private pilots have an instrument rating before they adventure abroad?
Definitely not a requirement.
Can a single engine pilot with low hours fly safely to Europe?
Most definitely yes.
Are UK flying schools preparing private pilots to fly outside the country?
Not all of them.
Very good, and somehow controversial, I would say. Fantastic. We are going to come back to all of these things. Indeed, they are. We are going to talk about that in a moment. But before we do that, I would actually love to get back to sort of the beginning of this story and ask how you did get into aviation so our listeners can understand your background.
Yeah, you bet. I started flying when I was 15 years old. And for a 3-year period, my family lived in Cincinnati, Ohio. So we were in the US. And the company that my father was working for at the time had a fleet of Gulfstreams. And he was middle management. And he was invited to take his family to a NASCAR race, which the company sponsored one of the cars. And so we flew they clearly had invited other families too. It was a packed Gulfstream and they filled every single seat. So clearly making the most of the experience. And anyway, we got on the plane and landed in Daytona Beach. And in the car on the way from the airport to the racetrack, my mom asked me if I was feeling okay. Now, at that time, I was pretty prone to motion sickness in the car when we were in car rides. And I was totally fine. I loved it. What a flight. She says, oh, well, I wasn't quite sure because you spent the whole time up in the cockpit. And of course, the old adage was, you know, when you're getting car sick is to look straight ahead, right? And pick a point that's not moving. And so she thought that's what I was doing in the airplane. And I said, no, I was just chatting with the pilots. And so on the way back, I basically did the same. I turned left instead of turning right. And the captain who ran the flight department was a guy called Captain Dave Brown. And at the end, he gave me his flight briefing pack, you know, a stack of papers that was an inch thick. And of course, I didn't know what any of it meant, but it was all the NOTAMs, the weather en route, and of course, at our destination and departure points, flight plan, you know, the regular stuff that we now have in our, anyway, I still have that pack of papers. Mm-hmm. And he said, Philippe, you really need to call around the flight schools at Lunken Field and take a trial lesson. And so I did. And I rung around. I got all the answers that I needed to start learning how to fly. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, you got to take me to the airport. She goes, where are you going? I said, no, not Cincinnati main airport, Lunken Field, a private one. I'm doing a flight lesson. And she says, okay, sure. So she took me, I couldn't even drive a car. And that's the beginning of history for me. That's where life began. No, that's where life got better, I guess. And very, very blessed. I would referee soccer matches, controversial, but it's football matches on a Saturday. Exactly, yeah. And I got paid between $18 and $20 per match. I did five of them on a Saturday. And on a Sunday, I did an hour of flying. And that's how I got my license. And then, just once it's in your blood, I just couldn't go away from it.
That's interesting because so many people always ask, how can I fund my expensive dream of becoming a pilot? And there are always ways. I always say you don't need to be learning to fly on the most expensive airplane available in the Aero Club. You can start to fly on the cheapest one, and that will make a difference.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I started on a Cessna 152, and they're great, fantastic training platform. You know, I mean, that's how I did it. You know, I was 15, and $100 was a lot of money. And but you're not forking it all out at once, right? I mean, when I started, I didn't have even that first $100. I had to find that, you know, first off, right? And I think if you're motivated enough, then you'll find a way. I mean, I remember then when I went to university, I did three jobs at university so that I could continue to fly, you know, when I was there. And I just, when you want it enough, nothing will stop you.
Absolutely. You just told us about being a football referee and working at the university. And for me, that just shows that you already had entrepreneurial spirit from a young age, and we can see that throughout your career. So how do you get from becoming a pilot to then today running Echelon Air?
Yeah, sure. So I went to university, and it was for non-aviation related things, which was a promise that I made to my parents that I wouldn't go and pigeonhole my education into one of aviation. And so afterwards, still had the passion for flying, of course. I got my more advanced ratings almost immediately after university and started flight instructing. Then I moved to Florida for actually very near Daytona, where it all began. And for a year, I was in Florida. I realized quickly that Florida wasn't going to be a long time home for me. And so I actually quit flying and I moved to London. And it was a relatively easy move. I grew up in Europe, and my parents were sort of spending a lot more time in London at that time. So it was easy to move there. Found a job at a PR agency and was supporting companies in the UK, List and the public markets from a PR perspective. And then changed to another agency, did a bit more on the marketing side, program management, but still in communications before I left to sort of go on my own. So that last agency I was with gave me an enormous amount of freedom to go and try to build an aviation practice and consolidate sort of all the aviation work from around the world. And I just loved it so much that I thought it was going quite well. So I thought I'd go and try it on my own. And indeed, but very quickly thereafter, I was put in touch with Cirrus. Well, put in touch, I saw that they were trying to grow their presence, their PR presence. And this was when Cirrus was, I guess you can say, going through a stage of maturity. They were going from a bootstrapped OEM. They had developed the concepts of the Cirrus Life. They were starting to, although they were already the best selling, they were really starting to now change the industry. Also with their flight training, better product support, and really trying to drive forward. So they were investing quite heavily in their in their image. And so I kind of rode that wave for a little bit, and they actually didn't want to hire our agency because we were small and in Europe, and they're a U.S. company and wanted something closer. But they did send a job spec and say, hey, if you know anybody for this role, which was a business development role for their European operations. And I just looked at the job spec and I laughed right away. The first things were, has 7 years of sales and marketing experience, speaks multiple European languages, ability to work in the U.S. and in Europe. FAA commercial pilot license with flight instructor preferred. And then that was, those are the things before even like being a nice guy, came on the job spec. So anyway, so this is uncanny, but there's not that many people that fit exactly, that tick every single box on your job spec, but I happen to tick every box. So I said, can we at least have a chat? Anyway, I met, who then became my boss. I met him at Heathrow Airport. As he was on his way to the U.S. to go to Oshkosh. And so we met. Obviously, something went well. From my side, it went very well. He put the keys of his Cirrus demonstrator on the table at the Costa in Heathrow Airport. And he said, this is your company car. And I go, okay, I accept the role. He goes, Philippe, you don't have the role yet. You have to interview first. I said, that's okay. I'll come and interview, and then I'll accept the role. They brought me out to Oshkosh. I met with the management of the company, and obviously it went well, and I joined the team. So I was there for a couple years, 3 years, flying all over Europe, showing off the Cirrus product, the Cirrus Life, visiting all kinds of destinations, supporting the dealer network in Europe with demo flights and meeting customers and setting up events, these kinds of things. And we were always coming up against the same problems. So there was like a finance question. There was a flight training question in almost every territory. It was just really hard to find high quality Cirrus flight instruction that we could point, because we were doing a lot of conversation or having a lot of conversations with non-pilots who saw the utility of owning a Cirrus, maybe for their own business. I mean, I remember one guy in Switzerland, he had, he was an electronics distributor. And he had warehouses, which are by their very nature remote, right? Not in cities. So he had warehouses in France, in southern Germany, in northern Italy, and in Switzerland. And he'd have to be gone for 4 days to make a tour of all of those warehouses, right? And check in. With Cirrus ownership, he was able to do it in a day. Same exact tour, same time with his suppliers and warehouse staff, right? Mm-hmm. So much more efficient. And he had young family at home, so he saw immediately the utility. Well, guess what? I now have to find a flight instructor for him to get a private pilot's license in the first place. And that's where I was coming up against the challenge, right? Is that while the quality of the training was very high, there just wasn't enough of it. So I said, okay, let me start up Echelon Air, what has now become Echelon Air. And there's clearly a demand for this. Let's make it work. And that's kind of how we got started, yeah. And now we've grown the business. It's still flight training. And we have a fleet of G6 Cirruses. And then we've also now management, right? So people that are buying the airplane, needed the airplane to be looked after, right? You have your own sort of, let's say, nightmare stories, right? Yes. Where maybe a management business, you know, could have stepped in there and said, actually, you don't really need to do X, Y, and Z. I mean, we just saved a client $140,000 on an engine refit in the US. It went to a pre-purchase inspection. They said, you need a new engine. I said, that's ridiculous. We had a little bit of a back and forth, but you know, an owner who hasn't seen this happening, you know, a dozen times, you know, before, yes. It's just going to say, okay, if the mechanic says it's not airworthy, it's not airworthy. Right. So, yeah. You know, a little bit of pushback there. So there's the management business. And then I'm back in the sales world as well with doing pre-owned sales, a lot of Ciruses, but a lot of other stuff too. Mm-hmm. And that's the story. Yes. A long answer to what was a very simple question.
It's a fascinating one. And I, as you know, I recently got my first airplane, which is a Cirrus as well. And you almost feel like you need some angel on your side, just whispering to your ear, saying, "Do this, check that, or be careful with that," because in so many ways you can fall. And fall flat and really get hurt in this process. So I completely understand why you realize the need for the services you are providing today. You also mentioned that you flew all around Europe, and in preparation for this chat, I was Googling flying into Europe, and I lost the count of on many videos you turn up.
Oh no!
And that's because you it's because you fly with so many pilots that have YouTube channels, and the fun example is your friend Stefan Drury, and the count the amount or the list of places you've landed it's quite impressive. So I would like to ask you, Philippe, what are the big pros and cons of flying in Europe?
Well, the biggest one is you're using your license. I mean, the advantages are really endless. You know, there are places that I've taken my family, you know, that I've gone to with clients, that Steph and I flew, you know, as friends. There are places that I would never have visited. You know, there are places that maybe in the back of my mind I've always wanted to go, mm-hmm. I've always wanted to see. But there are places that now I've actually been, you know, and I give an example. I was in Ivalo, Finland in February doing ice driving in a McLaren GT car. You know, I mean, had you asked me in October if that was going to be an experience that aviation was going to give to me, I would have, of course, there's no way, right? But actually, Ivalo, yes. It's quite far, but it's a lot closer when you're flying there in your own little airplane, right? Now that's absolutely. Maybe an extreme example, mm-hmm. because it is really the extremes of Europe. But from London to the Alps, to the Western Alps, it's a 2 hour, 2.5 hour, well, 2 hours, a bit short, maybe 2.5 hour flight in any high performance single engine piston. It's so close. It's so incredibly close,
yes,
right?
Indeed.
And just, a week and a half ago, I did a trip it was in a Cirrus, but it was from London to Annecy. Then we made a couple stops en route to Innsbruck, then back to London, 2 days, completely VFR, you know, and it was an absolute ball, right? Stopping off in all kinds of places. It's so close. It's so close. So, but you don't even have to go that far to find Europe.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, we are talking about a big pro, which is like discovering Europe and exploring and building memories that you probably will never forget. And it's part of the reason why I like to fly with my family, because my children, I have two daughters, and they are growing up fast. And I really want to build these moments and memories that I know that in 10 years' time, I will look back and I will really miss it. But I'm a VFR pilot. And you just answered partially this question, which is, can I go to the Alps as a VFR pilot? And you just said yes. Is that really possible around this time of the year?
Yeah, I mean, this time of the year, the weather is certainly more reliable, right? I think as a VFR pilot, you want to build in maybe a little bit of flexibility in your schedule, yeah? So, you know, it's possible that an afternoon storm rolls through And if you're really committed to getting to a specific destination, well, that's going to be a little bit trickier, right? You know, I have canceled trips or changed or adjusted trips in the past where, you know, somebody said, I have to be back on a specific date. In fact, it's with Steph is one of those examples. 5 years ago, we were going to go to Iceland. And he said, I have to be back on the Friday. And so if you have to be anywhere, we're not going to go, right? Because looking at the weather, it's North Atlantic. It's not that predictable. That's when we ended up in Norway instead. So we still flew. Indeed. But we chose a route where the weather was maybe a little bit more predictable, right? And Norway was that place. And we knew that even if the weather over the North Atlantic closed in, we could fly, you know, down south and then across by the Netherlands and northern France to get back to the UK. So we had other alternatives. So I think if you're a VFR pilot, just build in that flexibility into your trip, I think is probably the key there.
Yes.
One of the biggest con about these trips is there is definitely a planning bit, but it's made worse by customs and immigration, you know? And I overcome that con, if you will, by just making a phone call the day before I go on a trip, right? There are very few places in northern France, maybe a few, but there's very few places that require more than 24 hours notice for customs. So if you have, if you're planning, and typically we're doing a trip like this, you know, I mean, it's not a last minute thing, you know, maybe it is, and there's still opportunities. Indeed, yes. If there are, right? I mean, Le2K, you can basically go, you send them an email 2 hours before. It's effectively when you're doing your pre-flight, you can send them a notification and then you arrive and the customs are right there already. And then you're in Europe, right? Once you're in Europe, you can go anywhere. You can truly go anywhere, right? That's what's amazing about it. So I'd say the one con is the customs and immigration, because that, again, if you get it wrong, you know, any fuel pump that you need to replace on your airplane is going to seem cheap.
Yes, absolutely. What we are saying here is that it is easier to fly in Europe to some extent if you take in consideration the planning that you should do day before, just to check that everything is in according to what customs and border is requesting.
Yeah, for sure. You know, in fact, we often get tripped up. So if you think about just VFR procedures in the UK, right, we'll call up a LARS service and we'll request a basic or a traffic service or a deconfliction or procedure, whatever one you're after. But typically basic or traffic, right, for us VFR pilots. And then you'll get a service. You have this whole passer message call, right? Which basically says who you are, where you are, your POB, where you came from and where you're going. Yeah. And what's your request. So that's in your passer message call. That's all they really need to know. And so when you get to France, let's say, or in Germany, right, it's mostly class echo. So you're in a controlled zone with a very specific, there's a known controller, which simplifies things quite a lot, right? I mean, you fly around London area. And in any given space in London, you could be talking to Heathrow Director, you could be talking to Stansted, you could be talking to Farnborough Lars North, you could be talking to, I mean, there's 5, 6, 7 frequencies that you can get a service in a specific point. In France and in Germany, typically there's only one. So actually it streams on it. And guess what? We have an app on our phone that 99% of European pilots have, right? That takes away all of the unknowns of which frequency it is, right? And that is SkyDemon. And bless the guys at SkyDemon. It's an incredibly useful tool, right? For us as when we don't know exactly where we're going. You hit that go fly button and get all the radios. This is a plug. We want sponsorship on the podcast by SkyDemon. As if they need it.
Let me just tell you something. I like to spend hours just scrolling and exploring all the information available in SkyDemon. Some people do it in social media. I just spend a lot of time using it, and it's absolutely fantastic for planning.
Yeah, it's a fun app to scroll through for sure. But as a planning tool, it's also, it's their briefing. It's extraordinary, right? So flying in France, and you know, your main countries, in Europe, you get, very clear, like radio guidance, right? Who it is you should be calling. And actually, I think What's more complex is when a European comes to the UK, right? Trying to figure out, and there's four frequencies that show up on SkyDaemon as like the ones you can talk to now. And then they say, pass your message. And a European pause like, well, what message do you want? Right. And you fly into France and you check in with the radio controller. They'll say, hey, tell me where you're from, where you're going, and you know, what it is you want. Right. And then they'll just say, yeah,
they will guide you. Yes.
Yeah, they'll guide
yes.
you a little bit. They'll just say, oh, radar contact. And that's it. That's it. Mm-hmm. Now you're under what is effectively the same as a basic service. Yeah. Except that they'll, if there's something that's, they're now tracking you, you're on their radar screen. Right. And if you're about to bust through some airspace, they're going to jump on if they have the time and say, hey, you know, that airspace, by the way, it's active, right? Or, hey, there's traffic, you know, 3 miles off your wing, like pay attention, right? And yes. so it becomes a little bit more fluid, right? And I think it's more, while radio phraseology is obviously very important, you know, flying in France and many parts of Europe is maybe a bit more conversational. So it feels more natural on the radio.
Yes, you don't need to know the particular quirks of that particular region or country to find your way through. And you mentioned something that is quite important, that, and to me at the beginning it took me a few minutes to realize, we barely have any Class E airspace in the UK. And in France, it's there's so much of it, and it's actually so easy to fly through it and get the support you need.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, remember Class E, so according to ICAO, you can enter and exit without being in radio contact, right? So you don't have to talk to anybody to fly uh-huh. through that space. But you know that yes. there is a single controller who controls that space. So if you need something, you know exactly yes. who to contact yes. and make your requests specifically mm-hmm. with them, right? And that's mm-hmm. at the end of the day, much easier from a planning perspective than what we have in the UK.
Yeah. So, Philip, we said that the big pro is use the license, go to places. And the big con is some potentially extra admin or planning that we need to take in consideration. And then you also talk about the fact that to some extent it's so easy to fly through France, for example, where you have one single point of contact that will ask you for the information that they need and then provide you with a service. As a new pilot, I'm not a new pilot anymore, but I still see myself as a new pilot. When I want to go to a new place, I find myself saying way too often something along the lines, I probably should go there with an instructor first. And then there is, as a result, I most often end up not going there anymore or anyway, because it will take me money to pay someone to fly with me. It will take more time. And when I fly, I want to go with the friends and with family. And then I get into this catch-22 situation where I start to lack confidence. So if I call you one day telling you exactly what I'm telling you now, what would you advise? How can I break this anxiety, almost like that comes from lack of experience to some extent, but how can someone that just has their license breaks these fear, let's say, of going somewhere without flying there first with someone more experienced?
Yeah, sure. I think take it in baby steps, right? You know, you said you holidayed in Le Touquet. Mm-hmm. So that's a fantastic first stop into Europe, right? And I know it's maybe a little overused by the Brits. You know, it's like going to mini England. There's a joke that it's London Le Touquet Airport. Right. But the reality is, like, it's a great space to learn how to cross the channel, right? To get comfortable talking to a French controller, because yeah, it's, you know, it's a different accent, right? And it's different phraseology.
Indeed.
So we just have to be a little bit more attuned, you know, and a little bit more flexible. They have point November, they have point Sierra Echo, you know, to enter and exit the zone, which we don't really have those kind of, you know, we have VRPs, which is what those are, but those are specific inbound routes. So it's all just a smidge different, right? It's not really that different, mm-hmm. right? We all know how to fly to a VRP and then fly a specific route in. But conceptually, we just, that begins to augment that fear profile of flying somewhere different, right? With a different procedure. We just think, oh my gosh, it's too much. But just take it in turn, right? Nobody's saying go fly into Samoritz Airport as your first trip, or what is Samadan, right? As your first trip into Europe. That's a complicated airport, right? It's at 4,500 or 5,000 feet in elevation. So the highest airport in Europe. There's a specific course you need to do. You have to have flown into it. Actually, that's a bad example because you have to have flown in with a flight instructor before and get before, a check out, right? Yeah. But you know, my point is, don't pick a difficult airport. Maybe Sanen is a better example. Sanen and Gstaad. All right, the traffic pattern is all kinds of wonky. Mm-hmm. It starts 1,500 feet above, so that's your downwind, and it's basically the runway sits right underneath your left wing. Right. So it's very tight. You have to turn off of it on your base leg. You don't see, as you're turning onto base, you don't see the runway until you're right about to turn onto final. So that's a complicated approach. Don't make that your first trip. Right. Build up to
Absolutely,
that. And do Le 2K first, where all you have is customs. Right. And where frankly, they're so used to having English people come and mess things up and do it in the English way in France that they're totally forgiving. Right. And I think that's, if there's one message, right, to get out there, it's you will make a mistake that a local person at your flying field doesn't do, right? And I'll put my hand up.
Yes.
I do them all the time. Yeah. I make a little mistake. Now, I always operate with the first point being a safe procedure, right? So I don't intend to go bombing into somewhere and completely ruining everything. That's never the point. I have the charts. I have all the map, all the frequencies, right? Everything I've done is my planning, which we do anyway, right? As pilots, we're programmed to plan. Yes. But if you make a little mistake, it's not that big of a deal, right? If you land on the wrong runway, probably a big deal, right? But if you're not at Point November, right? And you're like, I don't really know where Point November, you know, you click on the radio tower. I don't know where Point November is. That's exactly what the tower control is there to help you with, right? So overcoming the anxiety of making a mistake, I think, is almost as important as, you know, everything else, right? And we can minimize that by obviously planning, having everything, having even paper versions of the charts. You know, when I was doing these flights last week around Switzerland, you know, the first thing I told, I was with a client, I said, go and buy the Sky Guide charts. So the same, it's the equivalent of Pulleys in the UK. Go buy the Sky Guide charts from Sky Demon, right? It costs £36 and it's £36 or whatever it is worth every penny, right? Because now you have the charts. There's no more like going to each website, downloading them. So try to streamline a little bit, but have everything at the ready for you when you go. And then if you make a little mistake, that's okay. Just get on the radio and ask, you know, even if it's just an air to air place, you know, just get on the radio and ask. Yeah. And sometimes we can be a little bit hesitant to do that, I think, as pilots. And that's a big mistake.
That's a fantastic piece of advice, Philippe. My very first international flight was to Little K, and the feeling I had before the flight was that it would be challenging. I was concerned with flying over water, or we're talking to French air traffic controllers and getting different types of service, and obviously concerned with the language to some extent. So much was new for me. And I remember that once I landed, I said to myself, wow, I can actually do this.
Yeah.
You know, I can actually, now that I'm here, maybe I could go a bit further. I can probably next time fly to the West Coast or to the Channel Islands.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah, that first time, I think, is probably the hardest time. You know, but once you've done that, then that's it, right? It's about baby steps. So take your time, you know, and slowly work your way more and more into Europe. Or, now you've done Le 2K, you know, now you can probably push down into Annecy, you know, and close to the mountains, or, you know, fly down to Nice Airport, you know. There's so much to
see. That'll be lovely.
Yeah, and then but then you're in one country, right? There's no customs. The biggest con, you've already solved that problem.
Overcome, yes.
And then it's just a matter of flying, right?
Exactly. We are talking about what new pilots or even experienced pilots that never flew abroad can do. But is there anything flight schools here in the UK could do to help new pilots feel that their license isn't just a national license? In your opinion, Philippe, what could be done?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I'd actually take it back one step, right? How can we get flight schools to think about their license as a license to fly to places? It doesn't have to be international, right? So as a UK flight school, you know, your flight training has to happen at a primary place of flight training, and it has to happen in the UK. So you can't be going to France to do solo flights in France, right? Or to get a night rating or whatever the case might be. Like, the training has to happen in the UK. But where I think many flight schools do a disservice is, and in the UK, we have many, many airports, right? There are airports like every 5 to 10 miles. Where we do a disservice is we don't use all of those airports, right? So often we get somebody coming for a Cirrus transition course from their PA-28 or their Cessna 172. When they want to fly a Cirrus, they come to us for some specific training on a Cirrus. And what we're actually doing is we're spending a lot of time teaching them how to go to a fourth airport, right? They've flown 100 hours, you know, much of it getting their license, then, you know, some hours on their own. And they've only been, even in those hours on their own, they're going to the same three airports where they did their solo cross-country flights, right? And I think, Wait a minute, like, we're missing a trick here, right? Go to a fourth airport, and you know, you want to talk about, like, the fear of crossing the FIR and landing in France. There's too often we see there's a fear of just going to another place, right? Now, we don't make it easy in the UK because of PPR, which doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, by the way, but almost doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. You know, that shouldn't be, PPR shouldn't be a barrier to going to try to fly to somewhere new, right? And so where I think we can probably challenge the flight training industry is, how do we incorporate more airports into our flying regime, you know, or into our training regime, and into our syllabuses? And so we try to do that at Echelon Air. You know, we take off, we're based at Biggin, so we might meet at Biggin, but we're always going somewhere else for lunch, right? Okay, occasionally we come back to Biggin Hill, right? But we try to always go somewhere else for lunch, where, and I make it a thing about lunch, right? Like, everybody needs to eat. So you go different airports, and you're not going to go to the same airport.
But sorry to interrupt you. You are the king of snacks, aren't you, Philippe?
I do love my airplane snacks. Yeah, I think it's important to be well fed, have good nutrition while you're flying. You know, it maintains the energy levels. Good for learning. Good for flying. A lot more fun.
Absolutely.
Hashtag snacks on a plane.
Sorry, you were saying that we stop for lunch.
Yeah, but then, you know, incorporate that more into the training. Right. And so on your solo cross country, you're going to three airports, but you're using those as test beds to maybe on your next cross country, go to somewhere else. Right. And then go somewhere else. And I think when we're trying, and of course, you know, some people need to be, and I had to learn in as cheap a way as I possibly could. Right. And that's not, that I'm not unique in that way, but that doesn't mean that we have to go from Biggin Hill to Lydd and to Shoreham and back. Right. And like, make that the only cross country flights that we do, or the only other airports that we see. You know, we can incorporate a lot more into our, and focus a lot more on the cross country training, you know, and we can do that from day one. There's no reason why day one needs to be an A to A. From day one, they might not get everything about where you're going or, you know, what airport you're hitting up, but that's exactly what we're there to do as flight instructors, right? Is to take away the burden and slowly add the responsibilities of flying as they're understanding the concepts of flying, right? So, I mean, I've even flown with other flight instructors who don't feel comfortable enough going to other airports or have a real challenge planning that. And that's a real red flag. You know, they're the ones that are trying to open the opportunities for new entrants into aviation.
Yes.
So I think that's where we really do a disservice.
I kind of feel that we are just starting to touch a very hot and sensitive topic, because to some extent you already you know what needs to be done, and you do it for as a business, and you offer that service today to those who own an airplane, basically. Before I owned an airplane, I wanted to go to new places, but my aero club that rented the airplane to me said, "Oh, in order for you to go there, we need to go with you first." and that is another barrier. It's like they don't. Although I'm a certified pilot, aero clubs don't necessarily trust the pilots to go to a place for the first time without.
That's really interesting.
And without going there with someone else,
I've never heard that.
And I felt locked into these aero clubs. Like, okay, I can only go to new places if they fly with me, and then I can take my family and friends. I feel that there are so many things that go against private pilots in the UK to explore, as you said, not just abroad but even nationally, and that was part of the reason why I wanted to break out of this model of aero clubs and have more freedom and of flying when I want. But then I only need to deal with the confidence aspect of it, not with the politics and all the barriers that are created.
I challenge that aero club to think about their training practices, right? Because if they're concerned, right, about a mishap because a pilot hasn't been to that airport before, right? Then they need to have a real hard look at how they're training their pilots, right? And this is not an advertisement for Echelon Air, but that would be to me the big red flag, right? Is you're giving somebody a license to fly an airplane, but you're not allowing them the training standards are not high enough, I guess. I'm making a big assumption. But you know the training practices then are not high enough to allow them to fly that plane.
You're right.
Right. That to me is the disconnect. Right. Now I'll be perfectly honest. Right. At Echelon Air, we're not soloing people until they have 25 hours in the airplane. You know they already have seen a dozen airports by the time they go solo. Right. And I'm not saying that that's better or worse. The cost is significantly higher. So you know I don't want to hide from that. Mm-hmm. But then I'm very confident when we have a person solo that they can go and divert if they need to, you know, even on that first solo, if there's a problem on the runway. And that's because, well, at the end of the day, you know, somebody owns that airplane and we have to protect the asset as much as we have to protect the client.
We've been talking about how easy and challenging it is to fly. And our listeners are waiting for us to talk about, okay, but tell me where to go. Tell me where is that amazing destination? So I kind of wanted to ask you for three different places. And so the idea is that you'll give me one destination where we can spend a day, another for a weekend, and finally one where you could go and have a summer holiday.
Right. So, you know, if you think about a day trip, you don't really want to fly somewhere for 3 hours, you know, and then fly back. You're not going to see wherever you went, right? And so finding places that are within an hour flight is probably the key. So two big things there is like, where are you based? And then what are you flying? Yeah. And that
absolutely,
you know, that sort of determines it. Now, you know, I'm very fortunate, very lucky that I'm in London. So it's a central city and central for the UK. And close to the continent as far as the UK is concerned, we run a fleet of Cirruses, so even the least powerful one, the SR20, still going at 155 knots true airspeed. So you know, we're making some time, right? So for me, in that sense, it would be the Scilly Isles would be my day trip.
Very good.
And the Scilly Isles, so off the coast of Cornwall. In the Cirrus, it's about an hour and 20 minutes or so from London VFR. And, it's kind of like you landed in the Bahamas. You go there, you can hang out on the water's edge.
Blue water.
It's cold, but, it has a feel, of the Bahamas, which is super, super amazing. So that's a bit of a longer one, but, the airfield that's closer to London, which is great, is Beccles. And it's in Norwich, very much on the east side. and it's or just southeast of Norwich, I guess. They do parachuting there. So if you've ever wanted to go parachuting, just pop into Beckles and randomly jump into the back of their caravan and then jump out. But it's cool. It's a little bit quirky, and they recently redone it. So they have, it's a great little cafe. It's very quirky. And they also have a couple campers where you can spend the night, which are beautifully decked out, but just as a day trip, it's just kind of a fun aviation experience. That's a little bit off the beaten track. You know, Duxford is obviously a great destination and a day out at the museum. Yeah. I mean, and if you're just looking for lunch, Terweston, the cafe in Terweston is superb, but I don't think any of these places will surprise people. But Beckles is a good find, I think. So that's your day trip. So let's see, overnight trip. So an overnight trip, or let's say weekend it was, right? So two nights.
Yeah.
So your two night trip, you're going to go to Bourges in Switzerland. And we're assuming that it's summer, so it's consistent weather. So Bourges nestled in the mountains in the Alps. It's a long runway, very simple procedures, and the valley is quite wide. So as a mountain airport, it's a fairly straightforward one. Warning, they don't have avgas, so it's jet fueled only, and their opening hours are a little bit mixed. Now, up on the mountain is the Bürgenstock Hotel. And the Bürgenstock Hotel, it's probably one of the nicest views of a hotel from a hotel room in the Alps. You pay for the privilege, but let's not kid ourselves. It's only a weekend, and you've just flown your own airplane into the Alps. So pretty special there.
I kind of feel tempted to interrupt this podcast so I can just go there to the website and book it straight away.
Yeah.
I'll do it later.
It's a pretty special space. And the spa in this resort hotel, it's built out from the ledge of the mountain in this endless pool. So it's very Instagram-worthy. Yeah, that's a lovely one. And then where would I go if I want to spend a week of a holiday? So probably to the Pyrenees, and we would start maybe even just the west side of the Pyrenees to San Sebastian. And San Sebastian, you can easily spend 3-4 days there. You fly into the airport. They're also quite GA friendly, although they're a little bit restrictive on parking. So a fine airport. It's 20 minutes into San Sebastian. And there you have the tapas bars. You can have your pinchos, you know, with your glass of wine, and just eat away the evening, having little bites at each of the little spots, little bars. And then they have the funicular Monte Igualdo, which goes up along the beach on the other side of town. It goes up to the top. There's a little theme park up there, random, but it's there. Mm-hmm. Kind of fun if you have kids. Just a beautiful place. And from there, you can go and visit the countryside there. And it's just, you're in Spain, you're having as much jamón ibérico as you can have, pata negra. You're eating the delicacies of Spain. So very much a foodie trip, without a doubt. But just a lovely experience. And that, yeah, you could spend a week there without getting bored. And,
absolutely.
You know, it's not all that far. It's North Spain. If you need a fuel stop, you can stop in northern France. In Caen is also a great launch
point. La Rochelle.
Yeah, La Rochelle is a little bit further south. Another good fueling point with customs. So a few options on the way. Yeah. And you fly over on the way home. You fly over Bordeaux and the Loire Valley. I mean, pick up some wine on your return.
That's a great list of suggestions, and I encourage everyone to have a look at them. And again, if you are not there, just as Philippe said before, just start the north of France, pick an airfield and start small and build up from there. But on the other hand, Philippe, if someone wants help and wants to contact you, what's the best way to do it?
Yeah, reach out. No problem at all. I'm happy to throw out some suggestions. Or you can join one of our trips. Mm-hmm. So we do flying trips around Europe and try to go to new destinations. And mostly it's places that I or one of the flight instructors have always wanted to go. And so we package a trip around it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, reach out to us, hello@echelonair.com. And we're happy to have a chat.
Absolutely. If I text you tomorrow saying, I'm sat on my plane, I want to go to Nice, and I'm feeling anxious about it, what would your text back say?
You got this. Don't overthink it. Yeah. Make sure that you have customs arranged and immigration into France, and that your Sky Demon is fully charged on your phone and your iPad and up to date, and go and have a great time.
Philippe Pullman, thank you so much for coming here on the first episode. I'm so grateful. And I kind of feel that you just gave us a masterclass of how to manage our first flight and then how to take it from there. And thank you so much for sharing your life experience and this precious advice. And I'm pretty convinced that we will be doing more things together in the near future.
Fernando, I look forward to it. This has been an absolute pleasure. I love talking about the places I've been, and I feel so privileged to be in a position that I'm in to be able to share them with you and with everybody listening. And go out, have some adventures. The tailwinds are better than you think.
It was fantastic to have Philippe Pullman as our first guest, and I hope you feel as inspired as me to start exploring new destinations. You can find a list of Philippe's suggestions in the episode's notes. Over the upcoming series, we'll be reporting from some of Philippe's suggestions and talking with other inspiring aviators about their favorite destinations. Before we end this episode, and if you are listening in August 2023, I leave you with two flight suggestions for you and your family. The first is the Silverstone Festival between the 25th and 27th of August. Built as an epic end of summer, this family festival offers activities for everyone, including a fun fair, plenty of track races, camping, and concerts by McFly, Sugar Babes, and many more. The easiest way to fly to the event is to land at Weston, and then from there take a 15-minute taxi journey. If you have younger children, my next suggestion will delight them. Until the 3rd of September, your family can experience an immersive outdoor adventure across the grounds of Blenheim Palace. Paddington Locomotion takes audiences on a journey to meet their favorite characters from the Paddington stories, search for a buried treasure, and have the opportunity to hop on board of a real locomotive. Blenheim Palace is only 10 minutes away from Oxford Airport by taxi. You can find links to both suggestions in our episode notes. If you like this episode, please help us growing our community. You can help by sharing this episode with a friend. That's all for today. See you next time.